Two fat expats, everybody knows one. Two fat expats, every country has one. Me and you, a subject to the expat blues now and then. But when you take the blues and you make a podcast, you talk them out again, you talk them out again.
Oh. Oh dear, the practice.
Bit of Neil Diamond.
We loved it. And it wasn't Song Song Blue, as you told me yesterday.
It was Song Sung Blue. Yes. Okay. And we both grew up. We both grew up with a bit of Neil, didn't we?
I love Neil.
Yes.
I love Neil. So, Sarah, we're doing expats who have been around in
terror attacks
yeah. or terror situations.
Because we're a little over a week away from the bombings in Paris.
Yes.
And Beirut.
Yes.
Mali happened a couple of days ago.
Mm-hmm.
Brussels is in shutdown.
Mm-hmm.
And as of about an hour ago, Turkey has shot down a Russian fighter jet.
Yes, I
saw that.
So it is all happening. It is, isn't it? And so we were thinking, because obviously we have a lot of listeners in Paris and mm-hmm. we have listeners all over the world, and it was just quite striking to sort of see how that looks for an expat and
yeah.
what it looks like when you're a guest in a country and mm-hmm. something like that happens.
Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things, I think, when you wake, I mean, I woke up to messages from my mum and my sister, and you immediately rack your brain and almost do a roll call of,
yes.
do you know? And you actually had a friend who was on
yes.
holidays there, didn't you? But you
yeah.
know how you rack your brain? Who do I know? Is anyone visiting there? Mm. Do we know anyone that lives there?
Yes. Yeah. So I have a girlfriend who's currently in London and she's doing some study, and her husband and kids are here in Qatar,
mm-hmm.
and it was her birthday weekend, so she had posted sort of the day before, going to treat myself to a weekend in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, when you've seen that and you think, well, that's nice, Susie's on her way to Paris, and then yeah, the next morning sort of waking up and seeing that, and your first thought is, I wonder where she is, I wonder
yeah.
what she was doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's a bit of a night owl, so I knew she'd be out somewhere eating
yeah.
and whatever, and yeah, you instantly start doing a head count of
yeah,
everyone
you do.
Know.
Yeah,
yeah.
yeah.
And she actually told an incredible tale of sort of how she made her way home, because she relied solely on Twitter
mm-hmm.
and Facebook to sort mm-hmm. of map her way back to the hotel.
Yeah.
And she said you could just feel great chaos and police cars
uh-huh.
everywhere and that whole feeling.
Yeah.
But she was saying, because I was really thinking about her as an expat sort of wife and mother, it was the first time, although she'd been in London during the terror attacks and she'd
mm-hmm.
had all different experiences with New York and whatever, but this was the first time she'd been on her own without her family.
Yeah,
and
it'd
that
be a different feeling.
Oh, terrible
yeah.
feeling, because you realise that there's a whole bunch of people at home thinking, can you please just be safe?
Yeah.
Whereas
yeah.
if you're with your family, you might sort of go, well, we're going to carry on.
We're all together.
Yeah,
if we're going down, we're going down together.
That's right.
That's it. I've never been affected by, you know, personally by a terror attack. The only thing that I was thinking about this last night is my thoughts on flying have completely changed. I never used to get scared of getting on a plane.
Mm.
And in the last 2 years, I think when we've had the dramas with the Malaysian Airlines going down, and we're still not sure
exactly
what happened. But going home to Australia, I was petrified for a week leading up to it. And petrified because Matt wasn't sitting next to me.
Right.
That if we were going down, we weren't going down together.
Yes.
Like, I lost sleep, petrified.
It's that thing I remember.
I'd rather go down altogether.
Yeah, I know, but it's also that thing I always think about my friend Mandy. We were sitting by the beach and we were looking out and someone thought they saw a shark like miles and miles out,
mm-hmm.
and she turned and said to her husband, I just want you to know that if I was attacked by a shark, I would be terrified the entire time and I would die terribly. And just... And I always think that with a plane, because those last, you know, that whole way down
yeah.
or the bit where the plane rips open
yes.
or the whatever, I mean, they're
yeah.
horrible thoughts. But, yeah,
yeah.
You know that it would be, you can't even say, you know, when people drown, you go, oh, I hear it's very peaceful.
Yes, the best way to go.
I don't think a plane crash, no.
I just think I'd want it to
spontaneously combust and I didn't even know. Yes. That's how I want to go down.
Or the one where you run out of oxygen and everyone just goes to sleep.
Yeah, and if I'm going to go down, I'd actually like to be in first class lying down. So then it happens and I didn't even know.
Yeah,
I'm already asleep.
Well, you were so drunk.
Yes. But that's the only, I was thinking about, that's the only thing that really I think about now is every time I get on a plane, I'm looking at everyone. Mm. I look at the pilots to make sure they look happy.
Right.
Because, you know, after the German Wings flight, that pilot just flew.
He wasn't happy.
He was not happy. So I, you know, when you're bored, I'm like, yeah, he looks all right. He looks good. He looks happy.
The other day when we were flying with all the kids, one of the pilots had an iPad in front of him. And one of the kids said to Greg, I wonder what he's doing with the iPad. And Greg said, he's just checking Google Maps. Okay, so we spoke to some great expat women this week.
Yes.
And I thought we would start with Janet, who was in Jakarta in mm-hmm. the second Jakarta bombings. Well, I mean, there's been way more than two, mm-hmm. but the second hotel bombings. Mm-hmm. And I started off by asking Janet, who's now living in Singapore, how long she'd been in Jakarta before the bombing happened.
Okay.
So we moved there in December 2008, and the bombings were July the 17th, I believe, 2009.
Now, have you come up with July the 17th just off the top of your head, or is that just a date you will always remember?
It's a date I'll always remember because it was the day before my birthday and we were flying to Yogyakarta for my birthday. So my husband had been travelling through Indonesia that week. Friday morning we went to the airport and we met at the airport. So the driver took me in, he flew in from wherever he was coming from, and then we had to change terminals to go to the, you know, whatever the flight was to Yogyakarta. And we're walking through the airport and everyone stopped and they're looking up at the television screens. And we're like, what's going on? So we stopped and looked and we both kind of just looked at each other and went, oh my God, they have done it again. So this was obviously after the, you know, the Bali bombings. So we kind of didn't know what to do. We rang the company and said, right, what do we need to do? Because there was, you know, obviously the company had a security policy and that kind of stuff. And they said, well, if you're going to Jogja, just go. That's fine. There's no problem. I remember we rang my mother and said, you're going to hear about it. Well, if you haven't already heard about it, we are fine. We're getting out of Jakarta for the weekend, but we're fine. Rang his family and told them the same sort of thing. And off we went to Jogja for the weekend, not really understanding how big it had been. Obviously, over the weekend it developed because it was all over the news and that sort of stuff. And then, came back into town, I think, on the either the Sunday night or the Monday.
And Janet, did you know anyone who was in the hotel when it happened?
Yes. Earlier, I think it was probably even a couple of weeks beforehand, I had gone down to Perth. I would go quite regularly to Perth. And I had flown down and I was waiting at the baggage carousel and I was listening to a conversation these two guys were having. And a friend of mine, her husband had just been laid off. And one of the guys was a recruitment consultant. And I said, I'm really... please forgive me for overhearing, but I heard what you were talking about. And a friend of mine has just been told he's got no job. Can I please get your card? And then I could give it to him. So this guy's, yeah, sure, absolutely, no problem. So gave me his card and that was fine. And I went back to Jakarta a couple of weeks later, gave the card to the lady. And she actually rang me the Saturday morning when Jogja and said, how well did you know Nathan? I said, oh, not well. You know, I met him at the airport, told her the story, and she went, he was killed in the bombings. Another very good friend, her husband was very badly injured. He's now recovered. He still has back issues and leg issues as a result of it. Those are the two main ones. But I felt like everybody knew somebody who was there. But almost more terrifyingly was I've got two friends who were supposed to have been there. But one of them, it was his daughter's birthday, so he decided not to go. And the second one, there was a confusion with where the meeting was or what have you, and he didn't go either. So, you know, you just don't want to think about the what ifs if those two had gone.
How did it make you feel about being in Jakarta after that?
I, funnily enough, went a little bit downhill. I really was quite unhappy and quite unsettled. And I can only attribute it to that, because it was immediately after that that it happened. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know if I wanted to stay, and, you know, just was really, really very unsettled. I don't know how long it took for me to sort of get out of that period, but I did eventually. I mean, it wasn't an option to leave, but I just didn't feel, it's not that I didn't feel safe, I just didn't want to be there anymore. It was such a negative time, and it was such a, you know, it touched everybody in the expat community. Absolutely everybody was touched by it. So I think that was probably what it was for me, a just feeling of helplessness, or, yeah, I don't know.
And how do you feel that it changed the way people lived? Because for those that don't know, you know, the bomb went off in a hotel that was full of locals and expatriates. Did it change the way people started doing things? Did it change where people met and how they lived their lives?
I don't. So just speaking for I guess people I knew and the people I was with, I don't believe it did. In a great extent. Obviously, security was tightened when you went to a shopping centre or you went to a hotel and that sort of thing. I think as over time people realised, or, well, again, this is my understanding, was that this was a very planned and organised hit, and it wasn't a random bombing. They targeted that particular meeting. It was all business leaders that met on a regular basis, and my understanding is the florist in the hotel was involved in it, and he had been working there for some period of time. I mean, I don't know if these are true, but this is what I was led to believe. So I think people felt that it wasn't just a random let's go and blow something up. It was targeted because it was a Western hotel. This particular group was targeted because it was business leaders and expat business leaders. I mean, there was areas that they could have hit where they would have done more damage, as in human lives, but that was not, you know, we believe that that was not what they were trying to do. They were just trying to make, you know, a statement about who they could target. And because I think my understanding was the people that were at the meeting were only told that morning where the meeting was, or the day before where that meeting was. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't common knowledge, and that certainly got a bit tighter amongst those sorts of people. But I think, I don't know, I think from my perspective, no, it didn't change it dramatically. You possibly were a little bit more cautious, but I mean, even during that time, I didn't feel unsafe. I wasn't too scared to go out. It didn't stop me doing the things that I did.
And you love Jakarta, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, like, yeah, I really did. I enjoy. I mean, obviously that was a real low period for us, but I think I loved the Indonesian people that I dealt with. The Indonesian people that we came in touch with were just wonderful. The expat community is just fantastic. I think what I kind of felt when we first got there is everybody's in the same boat, particularly when you're new. You don't have any friends. You don't have your family around you. You don't know where to buy ham or cheese or milk or, you know, all those sorts of things. You don't know where to go to the doctor. So you have to put yourself out there. I went to ANZA, I went to BWA, and you just get swooped up by people that look after you, and you form friendships with people that are very, very close, very, very quickly. And to this day, some of those friendships are my closest friendships, people that I rely on, and, you know, we might not talk every 5 minutes, but you know that you can make a phone call and someone will be there for you, or, you know, whatever you need. And I think that's, to me, that was the thing, the best thing that I'll take out of Jakarta, was the expat community and the friends that I made there.
I think Janet sums up expat life perfectly when she said that friends become your family, and you become very close friends very quickly.
Yes.
And I think in a situation like that, you would all just be relying on each other even more so than what you normally do.
Yes.
And we've spoken about it before, that expat communities almost feel like a small country town, that
yeah.
everyone knows someone who is affected by
yeah.
what happened.
And she said that, didn't she? Yeah. She said everybody knew someone.
Yeah, and I think that's very a common thread with expat communities. And I think probably why we have a lot of listeners that are country people, yes, because we have very similar experiences.
Yeah, particularly really remote country people, don't we? Because it is the same.
Yeah.
And communities do pull together.
And Jenna always also said that they've done it again. And I just wondered, was that always in the back of her mind, that feeling of it could happen any day, or do you just go about your life and you don't think about it? I think nowadays with everything that's happening now, it's always now probably in the back of my mind more so than it used to be.
Do you think it floats away though?
Yeah, I think in a couple of weeks when something else happens, then that feeling will float away. But at the moment, it is constantly just sitting in the back of my mind.
Yes.
And it sort of then something goes away, and then Brussels is in lockdown. Yeah. And that sort of fades. And then Russia's been shot down over Turkey. You know?
You're right. An email came through from the school, and you know how it kind of pops up in the corner of your laptop, you know, without, and it said, safety alert. And it was from the school. And my instant thing was, what? And it was a weather warning.
We've had about 3 drops of rain here in Doha, which actually means that it is torrential. People can't drive.
It's flooding.
There's flood. You keep your children home from school. There is 3 drops, people.
It's like that. I have to laugh out loud. But you're right. Because of what's going on, you do.
That's where your mind's gone.
Your mind
to,
goes straight there.
Yeah. And I think also that phone call that Janet would have had to have made back to her family would be a very, very tough phone call.
Yeah.
And I would think that your family would want you to pack up and leave and come home. And we've spoken about this before. We've had people say to us, why would you move to the Middle East?
Yeah.
Why would you live there? And it's, well, this is my home. This is where we're raising a family. Mm-hmm. You don't just pack up and leave.
And you've made the analogy before that after the Sydney siege, you were very tempted to say to friends Sydney, well, why are you living there?
Because I was watching that live on the news here, and I would say 99% of our friends in Sydney worked in that area.
Mm-hmm.
Matt used to go to that cafe every week.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did I call my friend and say, well, you better pack up and move to the country. You better go up to Brisbane. It's probably safer there.
Yeah.
You don't say that because that's your home.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's what, you know, that's what I feel here. Obviously, I would never want to put our family in great danger.
Yeah.
But if something was to happen, I'm not going to up and leave.
Yeah.
And that's what they want anyway. That's what these terrorists want. They all want us to hate each other.
Yeah.
They all want the us and them mentality, and we've got to stop that.
Yes. Yeah. No, you're right.
There, I'm on my soapbox today.
Okay, so we also spoke to Victoria,
who
is a bit special, Sarah. Why?
Because she is my cousin. And when we were talking about doing this episode, my thoughts went straight to Tori because I knew that she'd been living in Mumbai during the attacks a few years ago. So I was hoping that she would be willing to do an interview, and she was.
Yes. All right. So we'll have a chat to Victoria. And, of course, the attacks in Mumbai were, again, in a hotel, but they were kind of spread out in one area.
Yeah, and it happened over a few days as well.
Yes. And I remember my friend Sally Sara was commenting on that for foreign correspondents in Australia, because she was a Mumbai correspondent. And terrifying, like absolutely, because people were locked in their hotel rooms, weren't they, and they were making their way through. Oh gosh. All right, we're going to have a chat to Victoria, and Victoria is a seasoned expat as well. She's now living in San Diego
with 2 gorgeous children.
She is. And I started off by asking her, where was she before she was in Mumbai?
So we were in Seoul, and then we went to Singapore, and then we moved to Mumbai from Singapore. And that was about sort of August 2008.
And had a terrorist attack even come into your mind? Like, when you were thinking about going to Mumbai, did either of you sort of think, oh, well, this is going to be a dangerous location to go? Or had the idea of safety come up?
No, and I think anything that I thought of in terms of safety, it would be more, you know, just regular issues on the street in a place that you don't know. Nothing about sort of terrorism or bombs or shootings or anything like that. No, I don't think it had crossed my mind at all.
Yeah.
I was more, we'd been for a visit, and it was more that I sort of stood out in a place, you know, where we look so different, and it's, you know, just a totally different culture. So I guess that's what the sort of things I was thinking about rather than anything on a huge scale.
And so where were you the nights of the terrorist attack in Mumbai?
Well, it was interesting actually, because as you'd know from moving to some of these places, you arrive and you think you'll find yourself at a house within a few weeks or a month, and it actually took us about 3 months there to find our apartment. And so in the meantime, we lived at the Oberoi Hotel, which is one of the hotels that was attacked, and we'd actually just moved out of there a couple of weeks before the Mumbai attacks, so that was a bit lucky. But we were at, on the actual evening, we were at a work colleague's house. He'd asked us over to have dinner with his family, a local family, and we were having dinner there, and something came on the news and he suggested that we go home, so our driver drove us home. So that's where we were on the actual day that it happened.
And what was that drive like home?
We were a little anxious, but like a lot of these things, I think they start with some news report and then they sort of build and escalate as time goes on. So when we first heard something had happened, we didn't know where it was, and it was something small that we weren't too concerned about, but sort of knew that we had to get home. And so we were a bit anxious in the car, but we got home and that was fine.
And then, Victoria, what did those next few hours look like? Where were you getting your information from, and who were you kind of communicating with?
My husband's work, I think, were from, I mean, it's a while ago now, but I think they were quite good in contacting everyone and making sure people were at home and giving updates. And otherwise it was just the television. I think we were told to stay at home. I think we were there for a couple of days because it carried on over 2 or 3 days from memory, and you basically just stayed at home and waited for emails from work and TV reports. That was about it, I think.
And how did your family feel at that time? Were they making contact with you?
None of them had been to India, or they still haven't actually, so they were all really anxious because all they were getting was news reports. But we'd fortunately sent them an email the night before when we knew something had happened, just to say that we were home and that we were safe and that that we were fine. And so I think that gave them some comfort. But, you know, when your family's in a place like that, it's very stressful. So, yeah, my mum was on the phone the whole time and really worried and wanting us to leave, I think.
What happened afterwards with you, Victoria? Did it change how you felt about Mumbai? Did it change your activities? Did you, you know, what did anything change for you, I guess, after the event?
Not in a huge way. I think what we did, it was in November and we were actually scheduled to go back to Australia for Christmas. So we ended up bringing that forward a bit and went home. I think we were home for 4 weeks. And then once we came back, everything just picked up again. And, you know, you have thoughts here and there when you're out in public about, you know, sort of this could be a situation where something could happen. But I think pretty quickly you just get back into the way of life and things pick up and things move on. And you just keep going, and you just feel lucky that you weren't in the wrong place at the wrong time, and that's all you can do, I think.
And did it change your expat perception at all? Did you suddenly say, okay, well, I don't want to go to anywhere too dangerous, or did you just think, well, that's just the way it is and this could happen anywhere we are?
Yeah, I think that. I think I thought this is just the way things are, but it gave me a stronger sense of the importance of making sure your family feel comfortable with where you are. And I think it was hard that they hadn't been to where we were living, because once your family, I don't know whether you've found this, but once your family come to where you are and see where your home is and that it's fine to walk down the street and that everything's okay, then they feel more comfortable when they're not there. But if they haven't seen where you are and don't really understand what the place is like, I think it's quite stressful for them. So
it's often the people that are the most frightened for you are the people that just really have no idea where you are.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And so once they do, then I think they feel more comfortable. So I quite like my mum in particular, whenever we've moved somewhere, once she's been, I think she feels a lot happier and more comfortable, you know, just knowing where we are and what it is. So, yeah, that made me think about that a lot more, I think.
And how do you think the expat community reacted as a whole? Do you think there were people that left for good after the attacks, or do you think they just kind of soldiered on?
Yeah, I think there's a big mix. There were a few people that just didn't feel at all comfortable and decided to leave, and I completely understand those feelings. And there were other people that were more like, no, you know, this can happen anywhere, and we don't want these people to ruin our lives, and we'll just soldier on, which is, you know, it's what's happening today as well, isn't it?
So I remember those attacks happened in the August, and we had moved to Abu Dhabi a month before. So this was our first expat experience. I remember Mum calling me and saying, you know, Tori's caught up in these, what's happening in Mumbai.
Yeah.
And it was that a little bit close to home. One, because yes, it was family, but two, it was expat.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think what's really important here is I think there was a bit of a case of Chinese whispers because I've only just found out that Tori was actually living in the Oberoi Hotel.
Right.
And that's where it happened. I thought she was in the Taj Hotel.
Right.
I have a memory that it was the Taj Hotel that she used to frequent with friends to go drinking.
Yeah.
So it's really important. I think this is something to take away that, because obviously I'm not going to be her first person that she calls when something happens, but you know, stories get told from sister to husband.
People almost want to make them a little bit more exciting,
yeah,
don't they?
Yeah, yeah. And people that haven't been to that area don't really know, you know, someone could say to us, oh, was that, you know, that big mall? Villaggio? Yeah, yeah, Villaggio, when it actually could have been Landmark.
Or Esdan. Yeah.
So I think that's something probably to take away is when you're getting ready to inform family, have your facts
very
straight.
Clear.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
And I think also I loved how Tori talked about the fear that her family had because they hadn't seen where she lived. They hadn't visited. And I think for us living in the Middle East, there is those connotations of you're moving to the Middle East and you have a vision.
She has war torn in front of her.
Yeah, and you have a vision of what that looks like.
Mm.
But I remember the first time our parents came to visit, it was, oh, so this is it. Oh, this is quite nice.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And when my best friend came to visit, now when I go home and we're sitting there and people are asking all these crazy questions, she just sits there and giggles because she's been here. She knows what it's like, and she can actually almost stick up for me a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, she's living a very normal life. It's a little bit different, but you know, day to day, it kind of looks the same. And I think it's really important if you can have your friends and family visit,
absolutely,
so they can see it and they can visualize it. And you know, when you're back home, because the what you think it would look like is actually not all the time that. That's not the case.
People never picture the mundane. They never picture you unloading the washing machine or cooking dinner.
Yeah, I think
people
picture me, it's, you know, drinking the gin and tonic, getting my nails done in a 5-star hotel, you know, and like going out to brunch every weekend.
But also being on high terror alert at all times.
Yeah. And that's not the case.
No.
In fact, I probably feel safer here than I do back home.
Yeah. I'm always feeling fairly safe because there's that honking big military base here.
Yeah, because we have the largest American base outside of the States, I
think. Something like that.
Yeah. So that always makes me feel good.
big enough. They've got their own when Taco Bell.
About our little Nepalese security guard in our compound, who was about half my height and certainly half my weight.
No.
I always think, oh, I could probably knock out the terrorist before you could.
Yeah. We all know when shit goes down who not to go to.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think it's a really interesting point what she made, because I always felt the same with Libya, as my parents were horrified that we were going to Libya, because you do think...
And see, when Libya, I have this image, now when I listen to you talk about it, I think, okay, it's not as scary as...
I mean,
I wouldn't want to move there now.
But, yeah, when we were there, it was kind of like this quaint little place. Yeah. And, yes, you know, Gaddafi was this very scary man, but he didn't feature in my playgroup or my beach trips.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know, he was just someone that people whispered about.
Mm-hmm.
But I know when my parents came and, you know, I was saying they're from this tiny little country town, and they were walking the streets of Tripoli and just couldn't believe how kind and generous people mm-hmm. were. You know, my mum still tells the story of how she left 5 cents, the equivalent of 5 cents, behind at the shop, and this man ran after her down the road to give it to her.
Yeah.
And how you could go to the souk, which is kind of like in main Medina, and if you didn't have enough money, they'd just say, oh, come back next week.
Come back tomorrow. Yeah. And I think that's what you don't see back home.
What we
are fed back home. And I'm not going to say it's propaganda, but it is mm-hmm. almost,
yes.
yeah, you yeah. see, you only see the bad things back home.
Yeah.
And I think we've seen some really ugly things on social media this week.
Yes.
And we were actually saying to each other, but our friends back home don't necessarily have Muslim friends.
Yeah, because I was saying to you that a friend of mine, and I've been quite shocked and disappointed by some of the things mm-hmm. he's posted. And I had this moment where I thought, God, what do your Muslim friends think of you posting this? And then I realised he just didn't have any Muslim friends.
Yes.
And, yeah, I think that's the thing. We all gain huge communities. Now, I mean, you can live in central Sydney and have friends of 70 different nationalities and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe sometimes if you're in different communities, you just don't get the chance to meet those people.
And then what you're seeing on the news is always a bad, you know, visual of it all.
Yeah.
Then... I don't understand it, but I can see it because if they don't have any good role models, if they don't have friends that are part of that faith, and all they're seeing is all the badness on TV.
It's like how they kept showing in Australia this week. They kept showing a morning TV guy was standing in the streets of Paris and some firecrackers went off and the crowd took off.
Mm-hmm.
And they kept showing that clip over and over again because there is this look of horror in his face.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? And he runs and there's a big stampede. But the whole news part of it is that it wasn't anything. It was someone, some idiot let some firecrackers off. So maybe it was worthy of 2 minutes of airtime, mm-hmm. but it played for days.
Yeah.
You know, this sort of pampered newsreader, mm-hmm. a morning newsreader, and he is. He's a lovely guy, but he doesn't live a scary existence just shitting his pants because he thought of something bad happened. But it wasn't, you know, we build these stories up because they get more clicks, they get more fodder,
mm-hmm,
because
absolutely.
it makes better news than actually showing the boring mundane of how life kind of really is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, so
I was just, the other thing that I was going to point, I remember friends, so when the Arab Spring happened here, not in Qatar, but, you know, it rippled in Syria and Egypt and what have you, there was talks that perhaps it could happen here in Doha. It was all starting to happen and you were seeing things on Twitter and the Arab Spring and they're all going to revolt and there's going to be a revolution.
90,000 people, I think they said
it once. So I was sitting there going, gee, bloody hell, what's going on? So, of course, I went down to the supermarket, stockpiled water and canned goods in case I had to go into lockdown.
Yes.
And I did have friends laugh at me and my own husband laughed at me. But then you listen to Tori, they were stuck in their house for a couple of days.
Yes.
So I kind of think now, maybe I overreacted a tad. But if you are in a city that maybe is prone to something happening, and let's face it, that could be any city nowadays, maybe do have a few cans of baked beans and water and what have you, because you could be, you know, Brussels. They've been in lockdown for 3 days now.
But don't you think in most of those locations too, you tend to have a well-stocked pantry because you never know when you're going to see things again?
This is true. I mean, we talk about the chicken shortage of 2008. I think we've said that about five times on this podcast. At the moment, there's a turkey
shortage. Yes,
although the turkeys have just come in.
And there's a baking soda shortage. People aren't baking.
I'm predicting a tsunami of turkeys because they're all coming in this week.
So just fill up on...
Are you saying baking soda? There's no baking soda?
Oh, it's out. No one can find it in Doha.
Wow. See, I remember the tin tomato famine of 2000 and... And it seriously was. It would have been 2009. There were all these tin tomatoes and then the next week there were just none. God,
that's probably when the Arab Spring started and I've got them all in my pantry still, along with the baking soda and a few frozen turkeys.
Oh, dear. Okay, so lastly we have Gillian.
Mm-hmm.
And Gillian, really, she wins the prize.
From what I've heard you tell me about Gillian's story, this is like expat adventure extraordinaire.
Yes, so Gillian was in Yemen when Al-Qaeda decided to bomb her compound. It's not funny.
Yeah, well, I think we're those people that laugh when bad things happen and we're a bit nervy. That's why we're laughing. Yeah,
that's true.
And I'm also laughing because Yemen to me reminds me of an episode of Friends that if you're a fan of Friends, you will know when Chandler Bing tried to break up with his long-term girlfriend, she just wasn't having it.
Mm-hmm.
So he told her he'd been transferred to Yemen.
Yeah.
And she said to him, well, what's your address in Yemen so I can come and visit you? And it was 15 Yemen Street, Yemen. So when I think of Yemen, it's just Chandler moving to 15 Yemen Street, Yemen.
Yeah. I actually did have a friend that went to Yemen, but he, back then they didn't have any wives and partners that went to Yemen, and you definitely didn't take your kids there. It was deemed too scary. But obviously by the time Gillian was there, they were letting more wives and children, mm-hmm. but not a lot. But I think we should have a listen to her because I think she's an absolute trooper.
And okay.
It's a really interesting story. So I started by asking Gillian sort of how long she'd been in Yemen before the attack happened.
Okay.
We were actually in Yemen for about 2.5 years. Yeah, as I said, my kids were very young. So I had a little baby, and a 3.5-year-old. And it was interesting. You don't realize it's happening at the time.
Wow.
You're just thinking, what's that noise? It sounded like the back of a dump truck when it closes, like kind of a very metallic bang, bang, bang. And we just kind of, oh, that's not a good noise.
So you were living on a compound in Yemen. I imagine was the security very, very, I would have thought the security was very tight in Yemen when you were living there.
Yes, it was extremely tight. We didn't leave the compound without an armed escort. My husband's company at the time was very strict on security. The compound itself had like 5-meter walls, razor wire, the whole nine yards, right? And apparently these missiles, the mortars were shot from a mountaintop into the compound. So they couldn't, that was the only thing they really couldn't plan for. And it ended up happening, so.
And can you tell me, when you were in Yemen, were there many other families living there at the time, or was it a place that kind of people were a little bit frightened to move to?
Definitely frightened to move to, but there were other families. Our company was an oil and gas company, a Canadian oil and gas company. There were a few others. Total was there, OMV. Generally, though, they did not have children. So you had older couples or younger couples or people that rotated into. So families themselves, not that many. There was a British school at the time, so they had embassies and other families there. But it was fairly small family-wise.
And what did a trip to the supermarket look like for you?
It involved calling, having our driver, because we didn't drive, call the security vehicle, so always two vehicles. I would go into the store and I'd have someone following me, or the guards would wait outside and wait for me. It was a little complicated. We used to have playgroups though, that we used to go up for mums and tots playgroups at other people's houses, and that was fine. So.
And did most people live on the same compound, or was it a matter of visiting from compound to compound if you went to do something like that?
We lived on the main compound. Most other people actually lived out in the neighborhood. Mind you, they were surrounded by security, but we were on the main expat compound. So we could visit private villas.
So we did get to go around, but it always involved calling the security vehicle and the main security room knowing exactly where we were.
So after what happened then, did you feel that perhaps you would have been safer if you'd been in a private villa, that you were more of a target living in a compound?
Yes, definitely, because that's where they know all the Westerners are, and they have a higher chance of hurting more people rather than a private villa where it's, you know, a family or, you know, it's a couple. So, yeah, definitely. We definitely felt like more of a target. And more of a target because we were the only company that required security vehicles and all of that. So when we went down to the souk, you know, we had, depending on how many of us there were, we could be anywhere from 4 to 6 armed guards with us. And so, you know, we already stand out. We stand out a bit more.
Could you walk me through what happened that day of the attack in the compound? What was your day looking like beforehand, and how did it all change?
It was a very normal day. It happened in the evening, so it was about 7:30. My husband's company, they provided kind of a canteen cafeteria thing. So we went there for supper. And we walked back to our apartment on the interior of the compound because my husband said that was safer instead of walking along the walls. Because he's like, you know, someone could throw something over these high walls, we'll walk on the inside. Half an hour after we got home, we heard these metallic thumps. So as I said before, like the back of a dump truck when it empties out its load. Thump, thump, thump. And I thought, oh no, we're going home, because that didn't sound like a good sound. And I think those 3 or 4 mortars were fired into the compound, hit the apartment buildings not far from where we were walking. And I guess they were anti-personnel ones, so it was just shrapnel that flew out everywhere. Fortunately, no one was hurt, but it was very close. So as soon as we heard the mortars, about 15 minutes later, my husband was called to a town hall company meeting. I had to close all the doors of the apartment, stay away from the windows, children on my lap, dogs around me, and wait for him to come home. So to figure out what we were doing. About an hour after that, he came home. Kate, all of you guys are on the flight out to Dubai the next morning, so that was about 12 hours. So there was myself, about a 12-year-old boy who was there with his dad, and a couple other wives. And so all of the dependents, they were shipping us out the next morning. My husband said to pack. I said, what? Like, well, how long do I go for? He's like, you're gone. Like, this is it. You are leaving Yemen, and that's it. So, yeah, I didn't sleep that night, and we're on the plane to Dubai at 10 the next morning, I think. Once again, a big security escort to get to the airport. And then we flew out the next morning. So it was a bit stressful because the children obviously didn't understand what was going on. Yeah, and we stayed in Dubai for about a week, and then my husband had to come back to work in Yemen, and the kids and I went back to Canada for the summer till they decided what to do with us.
Do you feel like you have unfinished business in Yemen? Like, I take it you never ever went back again?
I do and I don't, because my husband actually continued to work in Yemen on a rotational basis. So we lived in Dubai for a year, and then we moved back to Canada for 4 years. So 3 of those 4 years, he still worked in Yemen. So I could still see the apartment. We had we still had people we knew who lived there. So in some respects, it would have been nice to say goodbye to some of the people that I met personally. But I know my husband was able to do that for me. Had he not been able to do that, yes, definitely unfinished business there.
And so how did it change you, and how did it change some of your expat decisions?
I was thinking about this before we were talking. It's changed me in that I already know I can get through this, instead of just the big worry, what if something happens, what if we get evacuated? It's like, well, we already have been evacuated, and my children were so small, and it was just me going, oh no, what have I done for them? And so it kind of like the worst case scenario for us has happened, because it was very close to home. You know, it was 2 apartment buildings away, and, you know, I think my husband and I, as I said in the message, we're very, maybe a bit too blasé about it. So if something happens, say in, 150 kilometers away, I'm like, oh, that's a long way. That's okay. we're fine. I still believe in the good in people, and obviously we're back in the Middle East, so I don't think we're unsafe here. That being said, I wouldn't want to be back in Yemen or Syria or those sorts of places. We actually came back because my husband got a job working in Kurdistan, so he was going back into Iraq, which is also another hot spot as well. Because we've been through the worst case scenario, we kind of weigh things differently now. I ask him, is the security like Yemen? You know, is it, you know, what does this company provide that maybe our other company didn't? And does he feel that it's safe? Right. So I know where he's coming from. He knows that I've experienced this. So I think we discuss things more, even more level-headed, not as emotional about it.
Crazy.
I know.
Honey, we're moving to Yemen.
Yes.
Honey, we're out of milk. Round up the security guards and the armored vehicles. Could you imagine you go into your grocery shop and you forget that one item?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, sorry, I've got to call security guards, get the cars lined up, we're going back.
I know. And that's I believe, how it is in Nigeria as well. Mm-hmm. You have to take your armed guards. But, yeah. And I think that's the difference. When you round up expats, and people like to put expats in one little box, there's a big, big difference between being in Hong Kong and being in Yemen. Yes.
Just a little.
And what I think makes expats fascinating is that quite often they'll move from Yemen to Hong Kong to then to Turkey to then to Singapore. You know, like we...
I don't think you'd want Yemen as your last hurrah.
I don't know. You know, I think there are times for those locations. I think either you have to have really small children.
Yeah, because I think my time has come and gone. Yeah. I don't even know if it ever drove by.
I don't think it was ever there. I just cannot picture you in Yemen.
I don't know. Honestly, I think I'd either be an absolute wreck or I would just own it.
Yeah.
I'm pretty good in a crisis.
You are.
I am pretty good in a crisis. For some reason, having spilt water on the floor will send me into some type of tirade, but something dreadful happens and I remain calm.
But how would you get your nails done?
Well... I don't know. And is there an H&M in Yemen?
Would you be? I wonder, Sez, whether you would then. Be I would set it up. Started it up.
Yeah, yes. I would have Sarah Bear's right. House of Nails. Everyone would come to me. I'd be waxing. I'd do it
you
all.
Would.
Yeah.
You would.
Yeah.
You're right. And that's what they. That's what women do.
Me
in
Yemen.
Yes.
See, you can go to Yemen.
Yeah, halfway there.
Can I go to 15 Yemen Street, Yemen? But I mean. Gillian, brave.
Yes. She was
and amazing. Then not only that, but her husband has then gone back and has gone to other dangerous countries on his own. And I just, when Matt travels, I'm always like, oh, keep in contact. And I know we can't talk all the time, but if you can just send me a text message with a thumbs up emoji, then I know, because I worry.
Yeah.
And then knowing that your husband is in a place where something serious could happen. And if he said, I'll call you at 5.
Yeah.
5 o'clock rolls around, 5:30 rolls around, you know, they're sitting there and you have got no control. There's nothing you can do about it. And he could just be in a meeting that's run over.
Yeah, and it is a hideous feeling. I think, Sez, I have talked about it before, but I was at a coffee morning with a bunch of women where all of our partners all worked together, and it was a location where Greg used to work for this massive expat company, and they had, you know, over 100 spouses. And it was a really big coffee and there was a bomb scare at the office. So you just saw everybody's mobile phones going off and everybody with that same fear.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, knowing that the love of your life is evacuating the building and running down the fire escape. And it is, it's a revolting feeling. And I can't imagine when you're in a highly intense place. I think to live in those places where you're constantly thinking, well, it could happen.
Yeah.
I
mean, do you reckon they then have a lot of sex when they get back?
Yes.
Like that danger sex, like you could have died. Do you reckon that happens?
I reckon it would.
Maybe if there's expat marriages in problems, send your husband to Yemen. You'll either be, thank God he's gone, or we're going to get back on track.
Even then, when you heard Gillian's story of he went off to the safety meeting while she sat on the floor with the kids and the dogs in the middle of the room.
Yeah, yeah.
that is when, as a woman, I think you can get very, yes, well, you're there at the safety meeting getting all the
what about us? Yeah.
You know, and I do understand they don't want all the kids and everyone else going to the safety meeting because they don't want to worry everyone and scare everyone. But you're still the one that's stuck at home with the kids and the dog waiting to be told. Yeah. And that's that expat thing, isn't it, as the partner, whether you're man or woman, you're always waiting to get the information about what's going to go down.
Yeah, yeah, and that's absolutely. When you get peeved. And is your husband or your wife, whoever is the worker, are they keeping things a few from because Matt would. I know Matt would. He gives me like a highlights reel and then I realise, actually, no, that doesn't make sense. There's more to that story, isn't there? Yes. And then I get the full story.
Oh, we're living in a mud hut.
Yes. Like half of Matt's building could have been bombed out and he would come home and say, oh, it's just a scratch on the wall. Yeah. It's nothing, honey. Don't worry.
Yeah.
Do you know, that would be Matt. But I think, you know, we're joking around. I think really, honestly, it's all you can do
at
the moment because otherwise you're just going to spiral into sadness.
Yeah.
But I think it's really good to know if your company has evacuation and safety plans in place.
Yes.
Because Matt now works for a very large international company mm-hmm. that I'm sure would have procedures in place, mm-hmm. but his previous company was a cattery company,
mm-hmm.
and quite frankly, I don't think they would have given a rat's ass what would have happened.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, the example I used is we worked for, you know, a really big company, and when things got messy in Jakarta, they did evacuate everyone very quickly, and it was a matter of getting to the airport and a big sack of cash being there mm-hmm. saying, we will pay X for that to get on that plane and you will get us out of here.
Yeah.
And you want that comfort. Yeah.
You want the company that's got contingency and contingency money in place.
Yeah. And I think there's a point to be made here too, because I know when all this stuff happened in Libya, when we were in Qatar when the Arab Spring happened in Libya, and one of the things that was really interesting was I had local friends and I had expat friends.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when you see the difference between an expat and a local, because an expat gets out. Like they
and it's not their home. It's temporary.
And it's not their home, mm-hmm. whereas a local is left to face the tragedy of what goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think that stocks are hard to find when you're there, imagine how they are after war.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's no toothpaste, there's no mm-hmm. shampoo, because nothing can get into the country anymore. So I think as expats, we have to be really careful, you know, when we talk about evacuations and whatever, how lucky we are that absolutely. We can evacuate. You know, that we have a plan B.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of other people don't have
that. Yeah.
And
they're
the people that now are, you know, swimming from Syria to Turkey to get out.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I think quite often we forget that's what's happening.
And I think also that's something that would never happen to us being from Australia.
No.
I've been trying to explain that to friends back home that, block the borders, don't let anyone in. I don't think they understand. These people have nowhere to go back to.
No.
So imagine being in your home that then does not exist and you have got a young family.
Mm.
What else? Well, you would try and get into somewhere else, wouldn't you?
Of course you would. Like,
we'd be on a boat straight to New Zealand.
Yeah.
New Zealand.
Yes. But we'd never barrack for the All Blacks.
Oh, my God, no.
What would you barrack for if there was no Wallabies?
So if there was no more Australia?
Yeah, no more Australia. Who would you barrack for? New Zealand's playing. Well, you'd barrack for France if New Zealand were playing the French, wouldn't
you?
Yeah. Could you do the English? I could do the Scottish easily.
Could do the Scottish, could do the Irish.
Oh, she's English. Struggling with the English.
I think I'd go All Blacks. They've got a better looking team.
Yes, well, that's true.
It would just go into looks for me.
Or would you just say rugby? There's no rugby without the
Australia's gone. There's no rugby. Rugby's dead.
Okay, Sarah. So I just want to say thank you to the three ladies that told their story because I thought they were all fantastic.
Yeah.
What are we talking about with social media this week?
So talking about everything that's happened in Paris, there's been some real ugliness on Facebook, but there has been some absolute gorgeous videos.
Yeah.
One of my favourites was the Parisian father explaining the terrorist attack to his little boy
with the flowers.
With the flowers. That just absolutely got me. And then the Muslim man that stood, so there's a part of Paris that's almost become like this shrine.
Yes, isn't to that Paris. Where Plaza de Republic
Yes, is? Yeah. And there is a Muslim man that has blindfolded himself and he's just asking for hugs. Mm-hmm. And I'm watching it and it's, you know, I haven't got the lump in my throat yet. And then it was actually a woman that's standing in the crowd that you watch her watching it all happen.
And she's crying.
And she's crying, so then I just went. And last night, or yesterday in the States, they had the American Music Awards and Celine Dion sung a beautiful Edith Piaf song. Now, if my translation right, it's the Hymn of Love.
Right.
And I didn't understand a word she was singing, but
beautiful.
It was beautiful. And they just had gorgeous imagery in the back. So there's been some really lovely stuff.
Yeah.
I think that's what everyone has to remember, that love, I know this sounds really corny, but love does conquer all.
No, but, you know, it does sound corny, but it's the people should be doing more and more displays of it, because I think if we can keep showing it and keep doing it, well, then we do win.
Yeah. And like I said, they want us to hate everyone. They want us fighting against each other. So let's not give them that.
No. I will put in a link, actually. There was a great article in, I think it was either The Atlantic or in Mike, you know, that MIC dot. Yeah. I don't know whether that's what it's called. I think it's called Mike. But it was mothers of young men who had gone to join ISIS, mm-hmm. but there was an Australian woman and an English mm-hmm. woman, and it was fascinating.
Yep.
And in every case, these boys had some sort of issue, you know, and that they were getting treatment for, but they'd just been taken under the wing.
Well, they're groomed online. Yeah. They're groomed online. So.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But we'll put some really lovely videos that we found over the week. And then my other one was a video that you actually put up on your blog's Facebook page. And it was companies coming. And then you said, do you know anyone like this? Oh, what's this? So I clicked play. I think I've watched this video maybe 20, 30 times. And I'm rolling on the floor laughing. It is a comedian who has a show, like a web series on YouTube, called Chris Fleming. And he plays a character called Gail Waters. And she is that upper middle class American housewife where she has to be better than everyone else.
Yes.
Like if you've got one vase of flowers, she's going to put three.
Yeah.
If your kid got an A, well, then her kid got an A+.
Yeah.
And this video is about company is coming over for dinner.
And the stress.
And it just made me laugh because even though I have help at home, I still behave like that before someone comes.
Yeah, yeah.
And the funny thing was, Matt thinks that I'm the only woman in the whole wide world that behaves like that. And I try and tell him that I'm not.
I'm right there with you.
But this video is proof, because that's only been made because there is a stereotype.
Yeah.
And so, Matt, you are not married to this extraordinary woman. You are mm-hmm. married to an everyday woman that mm-hmm. has tantrums
mm-hmm.
before people come over.
Yeah, it's kind of that little mutter under your breath, you know, when you walk into the ensuite. Well, not the ensuite, but the bathroom that's downstairs. You know, everybody's got to
have the fancy towel and the fancy soap.
Have the fancy towel, and there's, you know, someone's dirty paw print. That's,
it's the muttering under the breath. Or the dining room chair that's not lined up perfectly with the rest of them. Really gets me.
Yep. The hand mark. What amazes me with my husband, and I can say this because he doesn't listen to the podcast, because he says that every day is a podcast at his house. But he will cook this amazing meal, or, you know, give you something absolute, bring out the most expensive cheese, the most beautiful glass of wine. But, you know, you might get it in a Vegemite cup.
Yeah.
And, you know, the bowl that Granny gave you that you just can't throw out because it's sentimental. Yeah. Or the coffee cup that's got Greg with a tractor on it that his Granny gave him when he was two. And it's like, we have nice things. Why can't you give it nice? Yeah. And that is because my husband is still the man that's quite happy to go with a grocery plastic bag with his lunch in it to work. He doesn't do fancy.
Yeah,
doesn't
Matt's
care.
Exactly the same way.
Doesn't care about fancy.
Yeah.
And I would give you a crap piece of cheese on a really great plate.
Oh, God, yeah. Like, I want you to walk into my house and ooh and ah all over that table setting.
Yeah.
Matt doesn't get that. He doesn't understand why I have got about 10 different types of placemats that I pull out at different, because, well, no, they were here last time for dinner, so they can't see that placemat again. He just doesn't get it. But this is a really funny video. And then I became a complete fangirl of Chris Fleming. Mm-hmm. And he's got a whole web series on YouTube. And they're all about 3 or 4 minutes long. Yeah. And you do see a lot of yourself in the character. Well, I know I do see a lot of me.
Yes. Now, did you see, I saw today, coming back, of the two Kates who do the Thermomix series?
Yes.
That looks fantastic. Yes, yeah. Oh,
just ignore funny. That child crying in the background. She's got to learn.
She needs to learn. Because they've both had babies while they've been gone. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, it was really funny. Really, really funny. That looked good. Now, the other thing I had listened to was, I think we said a couple of weeks ago about Lena Dunham's podcast coming out. It's now out. And it says, I was saying about listening to her and her friend Jemima Kirk talking. They were on a road trip.
And she's also on the show as well, Jemima.
Oh, Jemima plays, what's her character's name? The blonde hippie.
Yeah, she's the cousin of Shoshana.
Yes.
Now I've had a complete blank.
Blank of what her name is on the show, but she's Jemima Kirk in real life. But and she's always got this sort of slight English accent. She must have English parents. Yeah. And she must have come from some sort of celebrity family well, because what I hadn't realised is her and Lena Dunham have known each other since they were in middle school.
Oh, right.
And they went to school together. And Lena Dunham describes that Jemima Kirk was exactly like the character she plays on the show at school, because she was the one where you'd go to her house and Moby would be sitting at the table having breakfast.
Right.
Like it was that sort of house. Yeah. There was lots of cool stuff going on.
Yeah.
And that you can imagine Lena Dunham wasn't cool and groovy.
No.
And was pimply and just completely evidently trailed behind Jemima Kirk doing anything she wanted at any time.
Right.
And Jemima was, you know, then 15 and going to nightclubs and had 30-year-old boyfriends and doing whatever.
I would have been scared of a girl like that. I don't think I could have been friends with a girl like that.
Yeah, well, they kind of talk about how their friendship evolved and how it changed because, of course, now Lena's got all the power, I guess, and she's kind of taken off. But it was really interesting to hear how much they talked about it, because it was a real, it was that whole thing of when you watch girls, and as you know, for me as a 46-year-old, I watched, you know, 20-year-old girls talking about themselves going, oh my god, this is so self-absorbed.
And do you think we're getting just too old for that? Because I still really enjoy the show.
Yes.
But I can't relate to them because that's not my life anymore. Yeah. And even when I was that age, that wasn't really my life. I can see snippets of it that I can relate to.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of things that I watch now that I used to really love. And I feel like, have I crossed over the territory into I'm too old?
Yeah. Well, I always think, I used to go for coffee every Saturday morning with girlfriends, same cafe every Saturday morning, whether we'd had 2 hours sleep or 10 hours sleep. Mostly we'd had two.
Yep.
And we would dissect the night before, where we had all invariably got completely plastered, picked up a guy, and you know, all laughed and giggled and whatever, and then we'd sort of talk about it the next day. And I think about it now, it was incredibly self-absorbed. That's all we talked about was me.
But I guess when you don't have the family and you don't have the partner, all you do have is you.
Yeah. I find it really interesting, and it's something I'm not looking forward to with my teenage girls.
Oh, hello, look at me with an only child. Can you imagine how self-absorbed she's going to be?
I wonder if they will. I don't know, because I really did find listening to them talk, and I mean, now Jemima Kirk is a mother of two, and Lena Dunham made that point of, you know, you're never going to be distraught, you know, that we've had this falling out or whatever, because you're a mum now. You know, you have these other things.
Your priorities and your focus has changed.
But they still did do a lot of self-analysis.
Right.
You know, and I don't think we have that in Australia. I don't think you would hear two women off of television just talking about with such deep. I mean, you and I are sitting here crapping on about, you know, this happened to me or this happened to me.
Yeah.
But I don't say, well, Sarah, you know, tell me how you felt. Yeah. You know,
And like every other person in the States has a therapist.
Yes.
And Well, I think the Australian mentality is, she'll be right, mate. Get over it.
Yeah. And have we got that wrong or not? I don't know.
I think there's probably a happy medium.
Yeah.
Take a little bit of the Aussie, take a little bit of the American.
Still well worth listening to because I thought it was really insightful to sort of see that friendship and what had happened and that they had massive falling outs. One point that was made that I thought was great was that in a relationship like that, you don't have lots of different fights, you have the same fight over and over again. And I think that's very true for families. And we have these deep-seated issues and we're going to keep having the same fight over and over again, no matter what.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, something actually I laughed with my dad about. Obviously, Dad had been told before I came home my last trip, don't upset her. Because it's always, like, I put my dad up on a pedestal, I honestly do, but there's just a couple of things that we really butt heads, and probably because we're the same person, and he makes me cry.
Yeah.
Like, there's always a moment on my trip back home, and I'm 37, I'm married with a kid, yet my dad can still make me cry. And so we actually got to the end of the trip, and I said, Dad, we didn't have a falling out. You didn't make me cry. And then as Mum said, he still sees you as a five-year-old.
Yes.
He doesn't see you as a 37-year-old mother. He doesn't think you can cook. He doesn't think you can take care of yourself.
Yeah, my mum doesn't
either. Yeah. but it's always the same thing, and it has been since I was 15. We will fight over the same thing.
Yeah. My mum will still say to me, either me, mother of four, who's travelled all over the world, well, I guess it's probably about time you popped your jammies on.
My dad, if I'm going out with friends when I'm home, don't buy a drink off it. Don't let anyone buy you a drink. They could spike it. Dad, 37, married. I'm not looking for someone to buy me a drink. And he still stays awake until I get home.
Yeah.
Bless, but
yeah.
I'm an old girl now, Dad.
Yeah. Not too many people want to spike my drink now, Dad.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'd actually be a little bit flattered if my drink was spiked.
It must have been an accident.
Rehypnol, anyone? Anyone want to put Rehypnol in my Cosmo? I'm up for it.
Oh dear, okay, we are terrible.
We've laughed through this whole serious episode. We are really terrible.
You have to laugh.
No, we have to laugh.
Okay, so Sez, we will not be around next week
because it's chemo week.
We just need a song.
We need a theme song for chemo week.
So chemo tomorrow for me, which will probably wipe me out for a week. But then we'll be back the following week and ready to roll.
Not sure what we're going to talk about. We'll figure it out a day or two before.
If anyone has anything they want us to talk about.
Yes, let us know.
Please tell us. And I want to say thank you. I don't know if you saw, but we had sort of three different ratings yesterday or reviews or whatever. They were all fantastic. So thank you to people for leaving a review.
Yep.
Really gorgeous woman in London said she felt like she'd made a couple of new friends.
Oh, nice. Do you think she still wants to be friends with us after we've laughed our way around a whole episode on terrorism?
Or that you wouldn't barrack for the English rugby team.
Oh, yeah. No, I will.
I would barrack for that Wilkinson guy.
He is hot.
He is.
Yeah, he doesn't play anymore, though.
No.
Yeah.
I'll barrack for him while he commentates.
Okay.
Did you hear how he said that? Okay, we have to go.
We will see you soon.
Okay.
Bye,
everyone.